Okay, well, I'm Walter from the Netherlands.
Hello, Walter.
Just so you know who you're talking to a bit, I started doing research after I saw things happening on 9/11 that could not happen. That's impossible. And it led to so much research that I now see myself as a zombie before 9/11. And I decided at one point that I needed to make radio because if I shut up about this, I consider myself a traitor. So that's a little short introduction from my side. I got to know you via Bob Toscan, I guess. He n mentioned the Trivium to me, and I got into it, and I found it very interesting. So.
Yeah, well, the Trivium is a very useful tool, especially for helping to filter through information and derive certainty with the information coming in via the five senses, or to know what you need further research on.
Yeah. So, Jan, for the listeners, a short introduction. Could you do that for yourself?
Sure. Well, my name is Jan Irvin. I live in the Southern California mountains. I have been, I suppose, an activist for about 20 some years. I originally started with the California Hemp Initiative, which was to legalize industrial hemp for paper, fiber, fuel, and medicine. And of course, we still have not achieved that, but our work here in California did bring hemp back to countries like the Netherlands and Germany and Spain and France and England and Australia and many others. But we still have failed to achieve that goal in our own country. So I had worked with Jack Herer, the father of the hemp movement, for about 20 years, and he is the one who originally turned me on to the field of ethnomycology, which is basically the cultural use of mushrooms for various aspects, primarily spiritual, such as the psilocybe or magic mushrooms that your country banned last year that were legal for many years there, but they banned them because a tourist jumped off a bridge. And I'm sure them being illegal will cause far more problems. And I know that the Netherlands right now are trying to ban tourists from the coffee shops, which is only going to cause a black market. And either Canada or, either Vancouver, BC, or California will be happy to take that business as we have our own booming industries now. And so, anyway, from there, I wrote my first book, Astrotheology and Shamanism, with Andrew Rutaji back in, I started writing that in 2003. It was published in December 2005. I wrote my second book that I published in October 2008, which is called The Holy Mushroom: Evidence of Mushrooms in Judeo-Christianity. And in that book, I published the first primary ancient text that Christian text that shows definitively the holy mushroom being discussed in an ancient primary text. So we were able to validate that history, as well as show many ancient icons revealing the mushroom. And I also host the Gnostic Media podcast at gnosticmedia.com. That's Gnostic media.com. I'm the publisher for John Allegro's famous book, The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross. I'm also the curator for John Allegro's website, which is johnallegro.org. And I run hempforfuel.com. And I also run, which we're probably here to discuss today, triviumeducation.com.
Yes, indeed.
So.
Astrotheology, that sounds interesting. It has to do, I guess, with mythological stories.
Well, it's basically how the ancients took the sun and the stars and the moon and planets and basically anthropomorphized them into godlike deities. They created mythologies around them to know when to plant and to harvest and these sorts of things. And astrotheology has gotten a lot of attention since the Zeitgeist film, especially Zeitgeist One, when it came out. It drew a lot of attention, but Zeitgeist One, Peter Joseph had poorly presented the data in part one, and he received a lot of attacks for it. But part one actually had a companion that came out with it, and all of the attacks that I see against astrotheology, they avoid the companion that came out with Zeitgeist, and I've never seen an attack against Zeitgeist Part 1 by anyone who's actually gone out and read all four or five of Acharya S.'s books. And I myself have published ancient 4th century primary texts discussing discussing astrotheology from Church Father Epiphanius. And so this is, you know, a lot of people will claim that this stuff is all related to Madame Blavatsky and Theosophy, and it's all a creation in the 1800s and this sort of nonsense. You know, but of course, it's a little bit difficult to sustain when I have documents sitting here in front of me that are 1,400 years older than that.
Yeah, so. I did a lot of research into the Indian mythology, and I find a lot of correlations also. So it's a bit older than Blavatsky, shall we say.
Oh, sure. You know, and she was just one reporting on it, but you know, there are numerous ancient texts, and in fact, Acharya's last book, Christ in Egypt, publishes numerous primary Egyptian documents that discuss these things as well. And of course, you have this guy, Chris White, who does this Nowhere to Run podcast, and he puts out these videos like debunking Zeitgeist or debunking David Icke, or, you know, he's always attacking somebody. And I had a very long phone conversation with this guy one time, and he admitted to me that he's never read any of the books by the people that he attacks. And so, of course, you know, he can sit there on a soapbox and claim that there is no evidence because he refuses to actually look at any of the evidence, right? So he constantly argues from ignorance, which under the trivium, that's a fallacy.
Yep, indeed. So, did Aristotle start this?
Well, Aristotle started the foundation of the trivium, and Pythagoras started the foundation of the quadrivium, which was, of course, before Aristotle. And then Thomas Aquinas is the one who really began to put together the logical fallacies.
Okay.
And so we have, you know, there was a spread of about 1700 years where the core of the trivium was developed from Aristotle to Thomas Aquinas. The core of it was developed by Aristotle. And let me explain a little bit. I'm sure your audience is probably wondering what the trivium is. So let's go into that for a minute here.
Yes.
The trivium is composed of three things, and the trivium and quadrivium together make up what is known as the classical seven liberal arts. And the word liberal has been misused for the last several decades to cover over the fact of what the trivium and the seven liberal arts really are, and I'll cover more of that in a moment. But I should say that the word liberal comes from liber, which is Latin for book, and it's also where we get the word freedom from. So freedom is in the books, and the reason why they attack or they misuse the word liberal constantly in the corporate or mainstream media is because they don't want people to realize that freedom or liberty is in the books, that where they would learn about how they're being controlled. And during Roman times, the first thing that a slave would do upon gaining freedom would be to study the seven liberal arts, or the trivium and the quadrivium. So this was the sign of a free person, and freedom and book are directly associated. So the trivium is grammar, or general grammar, formal logic, and classical rhetoric. And grammar answers the questions of who, what, where, and when of a subject. And it is discovering and ordering the facts of reality, and comprises a basic systematic knowledge. So general grammar is knowledge. In other words, like, let's say you have a car. You have all these, you want to build a car, okay? And you have all the parts to the car. You can't have a car before you have the parts. So general grammar is the parts of the car. And knowing all the parts and where they go and understanding everything about them, that's your grammar, that's your knowledge, okay? And then the understanding is being able to remove all of the contradictions or all of those parts laying on the floor and put them together in a systematic fashion, just like you would do With grammar, you take letters and punctuation, and you build words and sentences. That's the same idea. In the logic aspect, you take the parts of the car, whatever, or the parts of the words, and you're putting them together. You're removing the contradictions, and with logic, logic answers the question of why, and logic is also known as dialectic, which is understanding. And it's developing the faculty of reason in establishing valid or non-contradictory relationships among facts and yields basic systematic understanding. And so, again, you can't have understanding before you have knowledge. You have to have the building blocks, you have to have the letters, you have to have the parts before you can have understanding of what those things are and how they go together, right? And then the third stage of the trivium is rhetoric, which is the how of a subject, or more effectively, it's wisdom, and applying knowledge and understanding expressively to others. In other words, it's a systematically usable knowledge and understanding that you can pass on to other people. So, and in our analogy of the car and the car parts, the rhetoric aspect would be, let's say, the manual that explains to you exactly where all the parts go and how they go together. It's explaining how it was done to someone else so that they can understand it clearly.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so general grammar, you say, is knowledge. But then my understanding of what is grammar must be flawed, because all I know and could come up with when I thought of grammar is that they taught us in school the letters and how to build sentences.
Well, see, as I was just giving you the example, you do have that. See, letters are parts, are they not? Aren't the letters the parts of words?
Sure.
Right? Okay, so there's two different ways of looking at grammar. Grammar can be looked at as special grammar, which properly relates words to other words with a specified language like English, Latin, Russian, Dutch, or Netherlands, you know, so that you have an understanding of those letters. But general grammar is the same idea, taking it from letters or parts of words and dealing with parts of reality. Like you look outside, or you look at your house, you know, the things that compose your house, the parts, the boards or the walls and the windows and the wires that make up the circuitry in the house for the lights and all of, you know, the counters and all of these things. These are these are grammar of your house. And so when we begin to understand that parts of reality can also be seen as grammar, then we can begin to systematically itemize and identify these items. And you know, logic is the art of non-contradictory identification. So first you have
That's Ayn Rand, isn't it?
Right, that is Ayn Rand, and that's one thing that she got right. You know, the problem with Ayn Rand's philosophy, in my opinion, is like in Atlas Shrugged, she repeatedly uses the appeal to authority fallacy with characters like John Galt and, you know, allowing these wealthy elites to have full control and they should just know better when, you know, this has been shown as doesn't play out in reality. But also, Ayn Rand had her grammar and logic mixed up. She didn't have the basis of the trivium. So what she did was she put grammar before logic. The trivium must always be grammar, logic, rhetoric. How can you possibly have logic before grammar? How can you have a house before you know what the parts are to build the house? How can you have a car before you know what the parts are to build the car? You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So you know, Ayn Rand's issue was that she put her logic before her grammar, and she would come to conclusions without gathering her data or her knowledge base effectively first. So what would happen in the case of Ayn Rand, let's say, you know, she would say all Europeans are, you know, are pro-socialist or whatever. I lived in Europe for a year and a half, and I find that to be a hasty generalization, a fallacy. She wasn't, you know, she would do this often, but she would, one of the primary problems with Ayn Rand's philosophy is it's not in her logic, it's not in the objectivism itself, it's in the fact that her grammar and logic were mixed up. So with that, she for instance, when she looked at history, she would look at history through rose-colored lenses. She would basically believe all of the official history coming from the government, or as in Old English, governmente, or Middle English, governmente, which comes from gubernare, which is to steer or control, and mente, or mind, which is to control the mind control, right?
Yeah.
So, and this, you know, if people want to look more into that, it's not, government is not the suffix ment at the end. In Middle and Old English, it was mente, it's governmente, which was mind control, and I've posted some explanations of that up on my website. But because she had this mix-up of her grammar and logic, she didn't go out and properly gather data first before she drew her conclusions on how our society worked exactly. So with that, with this error, she could say, argue that the elitists were doing things in our best interest, whereas she had gone out and read the works of, say, Professor Carol Quigley or Professor Anthony Sutton or like Douglas Reed's work, Controversy of Zion, stuff like this. She wouldn't have been able to, you know, make those errors or those fallacies, those appeal to authority fallacies and other fallacies that she made in her works, and she would have presented a lot more usable philosophy. However, if we go through and we understand these things, there is a lot of value to be gained in studying some of her theories, but you just have to understand where the flaws are in her logic, right?
Mm-hmm.
So anyway.
Yeah, the logical, I'm losing it here. There's two kinds, I believe. There's deductive and inductive logical reasoning, right?
Right.
And
deductive is basically, to oversimplify, it's really where you have an idea, and then you go out and you look for evidence of it out in reality, right? Whereas inductive is, say, you... Like, let's say you see 10 dogs, and these 10 dogs have tails, and every time these 10 dogs wag their tails, you notice that they're all happy, and they're running around and excited, and, you know, and so then you decide, well, I'm going to induce that all dogs, when they're happy, wag their tails. So that's inductive knowledge, right? Where deductive is exactly the opposite of that. You know, it's saying, you know, all dogs have wagging tails and then building the evidence for it. I believe that's the proper analogy.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, inductive is generalizing and building versus deductive is starting with what one knows.
Yeah.
And but what's interesting is when we get into inductive versus deductive, all of the laws of physics, like the law of gravity or any of Newtonian physics and things like that, all of the laws that make our computers work, that make anything that we do in reality function, all come from inductive knowledge, whereas deductive is like more of like Kantian philosophy, which is, we call it contradictions. You know, Kantian
A-N-T for the people that didn't get it.
Yes, K-A-N-T. And Kant, he would basically, you know, dream up an idea and then say it was reality without fact-checking it with anything outside. So, you know, they're two different philosophies going in either direction, but there is value in both and understanding both. Inductive philosophy has been severely marginalized. And in fact, I interviewed David Harriman recently, who's the first person to try and put together a clear philosophy of induction, as it's never been sufficiently done before. And, you know, so people can go on my podcast on GnosticMedia.com and check that out. And it's very enlightening. And, you know, it takes the load of the world off your shoulders and allows you to realize that you're not just by waking up in the morning creating all of the problems in the world. You know what I mean?
So yeah, I tend to use both. I'm a little bit of a philosopher myself. deductive is easier for me because, you know, I can come up with any idea and then test it in reality, and you soon find out that it doesn't match. So, you know, you throw it out
right.
the window.
Well, see, but the problem with that is then, you know, it's like it's in the fallacy would be arguing the arbitrary, because you come up with an idea without evidence.
Mm-hmm.
It's arbitrary, and so therefore it's almost automatically dismissed. But that would... See, if we really went by that, then many of the modern inventions and things that we have wouldn't pan out. Like,
mm-hmm.
I've had many hunches and things like that where I've gone and checked it out, and it ended up being true. But at the same time, there are numerous ideas that I've had in my head that turned out to be completely BS. So you do have to be careful with that. At least with inductive knowledge, you're generalizing, but you're saying that all of these dogs right here in front of me that I can sense with my five senses, when I do this, they do that. And so I can generalize that that's true for all dogs, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's a little bit different. Or, you know, I'm sitting here breathing. My friend is breathing. All of the people that I've seen in my life have been breathing. I've never met everybody on the face of the planet before, but I can induce that all people breathe.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So that's inductive knowledge, okay?
Okay.
And so anyway... You want to go on to something else?
Yeah, I got here this the fallacy files in front of me, taxonomy of logical fallacies.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I thought
Well, the taxonomy of logical fallacies, and that's not from my website. That is somebody else's. But I should mention that is a little bit more of an advanced level of understanding of fallacies.
Yes, I understand. But I think the people, not only hosts, need weapons, so to speak.
Yes, well, absolutely. What I was going to say, though, is this page here, the taxonomy of logical fallacies, gives both formal and informal fallacies.
Okay.
Formal fallacies only happen in written word, whereas informal can be in both written and spoken.
Oh.
Okay, so what I prefer to do is focus most people strictly on informal fallacies first.
Okay, cool. Yeah.
Okay, so like, you know, if we go to like the top link there, which is at nizcor.org, the 42 most common informal fallacies with Dr. Michael Abosier there, you can see like the ad hominem fallacy, which is one of the most standard fallacies out there. It's person
A
makes a blank.
Could you name that slide again, please?
If you go to my triviumeducation.com website,
yeah, okay,
it's the first link there of the logical fallacies. It's directly, you'll see logical fallacies, common types of errors in reasoning. The first link there given under that is the nizcor.org.
Nizcor.org, yeah, I got it.
Okay.
There we go.
And so from there... Now I've just... Okay, so from there, you go to the top one is ad hominem.
Yep.
Person A makes claim X. Person B makes an attack on person A. So I say every week lately when I go outside, I see jet airliners flying back and forth spraying chemtrails in the air. They're not airliners, like, you know, just making a single pass. They're actually turning, flying back and forth, and you can see them leaving these trails in the sky. And person B says, you're a conspiracy theorist, you're a homosexual, you're a Republican, therefore your claim is false, right? So rather than dealing with the information I'm presented, person B attacks me for making the statement. So that's an ad hominem attack.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's another common fallacy is, I'm going to get into some of the appeal fallacies.
Please do.
Yeah, there's one of the most common ones is appeal to belief. You know, if you don't do X, God is going to come down and punish you. Right?
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, so that's an appeal to belief, you know, and it's like, well, you know, what if I don't believe in your God, right? So it's like, whatever, that doesn't mean anything to me, okay?
Uh-huh.
But so an appeal to belief is most people believe that claim X is true, therefore claim X is true. And that's one form of it, but appeal to belief is that, you know, basically you're using this religious aspect to sell something on somebody. You know, if you don't believe this, some religious outcome is going to happen. And, you know, this line of quote-unquote reasoning is fallacious because the fact that many people believe a claim does not in general serve as evidence that the claim is true. And so it's You know, like a million Frenchmen can't be wrong, right? Mm-hmm. Well, sure they can.
Yeah.
You know, it's very common for masses of people in society to be utterly wrong on a topic. I see it all the time in my research.
Yeah.
You know, excuse me, let me get some water here.
Sure. Normally, that would be an argument for me to not accept it because most people believe it.
Right. Exactly. And it is a fallacy. So it doesn't necessarily mean that it's wrong. It just means that here's a red flag. Let's go fact check this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, you know, there's appeal to common practice, appeal to consequences of a belief, appeal to emotion, appeal to fear. You know, if you don't do this, you know, if we don't go after, President Barack Obama uses appeal to fear constantly. Like, you know, if we don't go after these Al-Qaeda terrorists, which the U.S. funded and created in the 1950s and 60s, then XYZ is going to happen. You know, and we're the ones who have funded and sponsored and created these people from the beginning. And, you know, there's just a lot of neglected aspect and appeal to fear there. Another appeal to fallacy is the appeal to flattery. Your boss comes in and says, "Hi, Walter, that's a really nice suit you're wearing today. And is that a nice haircut? Wow, look at you. Hey, everybody, look at, doesn't Walter look fantastic today? Boy, Walter, I bet you're going to make $1 million for the company today, aren't you?" You know, so that would be like, that would be an appeal to flattery. There's appeal to novelty, which is a really common one. This was one of Terence McKenna's favorite ones. And appeal to novelty is because something is new, it's better than something that's old, right? And that's just, you know, not necessarily true. I mean,
okay, yeah.
The computer that's sitting in front of me today is better than the one that I owned 10 years ago, but it's better because it has, you know, 20 times more processing power. It's got 8 gigs of RAM. It's got all of these different things that my old 486 computer couldn't possibly have done. So therefore, for those reasons, it's better. But to say something is better just because it's new is ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and going on to appeal to ridicule, right? And appeal to ridicule is basically, you're wrong because, ha, 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 ha.
I get it, yeah.
Okay, so
you see that a lot in chat rooms.
Oh yeah, well, you know, and I was in a debate with a professor from the University of Kansas this week on my Facebook page, mm-hmm. and his most common fallacy that he used repeatedly, and this guy teaches logic, which makes him a bit of a sophist, but his most common fallacy that he used, other than neglected aspect, was appeal to ridicule.
Yeah.
So he would just constantly, you're wrong because, you know, so. You know, so we would just constantly just, you know, avoid even answering to his pathetic fallacies. And, you know, this is somebody who graduated from both Yale and Harvard and, you know, and teaches logic and is sitting there in a debate utilizing mm-hmm. fallacy after fallacy, even while he's being called out for each one.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, a lot of people do that kind of stuff. There's appeal to spite, appeal to tradition. There's
appeal to spite?
Well, appeal to spite is claim X is presented with the intent of generating spite, therefore claim C is false or true. So, you know, I say, what's an example? Well, here, I'll just read the example off the website. Here, Jill, I think I'll vote for Jane to be treasurer of now. Vicky, remember the time that your purse vanished at a meeting last year? Yes.
Okay.
Jill, yes. Well, I just found out that she stole your purse and stole some of other stuff from people. Jill, I'm not voting for her. You know, it's like, it's just based on spite. There's not really any evidence, direct evidence for the claim. It's, you know, I just found out. It's just an appeal to spite. So that it's to, you know, sway people from a decision that they would have made.
Yeah.
Appeal to tradition is, you know, my tribe or my culture or my family or my group has always done this, so therefore we're doing this.
Yeah.
Another well-known one is the bandwagon fallacy, and this one basically comes from like the 1800s in the USA, probably especially when politicians would load up a wagon with a band with you know, horn players and percussion,
oh.
And they would parade them around, and bang and make noise and draw attention to, you know, people to come up and listen to an argument simply because, you know, this person is you know, speaking from the bandwagon. Another evidence of it is person P is pressured by his or her peers or threatened with rejection, and therefore person P's claim or claim X is false. So 911 was an inside job. Well, you're either with us or against us. So, you know, and if you know, and if you're against us, we're going to kick you out of the country or something. So you have to be on the bandwagon with the rest of us, or, you know, we're going to punish you, or something is going to happen to you, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, well, that would be, there's ad baculum that I used in there also, which I got a little bit mixed up there. Ad baculum is an appeal to threat. It's basically saying that, you know, you're going to do this, or we're going to kick the crap out of you.
Okay.
And begging the question, that's a very common one that Christians love to use. Bill says, God must exist. How do you know? And Bill says, well, because the Bible says so. Why should I believe the Bible? Because the Bible was written by God. Mm-hmm. You know, so, okay, well, so what you're doing is say, well, right here, the Bible says the Bible was written by God. There's no external evidence that the Bible was written by God. So it's a begging the question or circular reason. It's circular reasoning. It's going back to the original source to prove your claim.
It's right? Referencing to itself. That's
it's referencing to itself. So it's just, it's circular logic. It's going nowhere. So you just dismiss it.
Yeah.
Sir, there's so many here. False dilemma, which is the one that I just used a second ago. You're either with us or you're against us.
That's even an attack, I think. I mean, they're forcing you to take a position, and that can't be good.
Yes, and you know, and Obama used this one recently in the speech that he gave on Osama bin Laden, but basically saying that, you know, there's some threat or some false dilemma, and therefore, you know, we have to go in and do this, or else this other thing is going to happen, right? Either claim X is true or claim Y is true. You're either with us or you're with the enemy.
Yeah.
When both could be true or false, and claim X is false, or claim Y is false, therefore claim X is true. So you're against us, so therefore you're with the terrorists, right? Which is just stupid.
Yep. Then there's gambler's fallacy. I think that one is used a lot.
Oh, yeah. Well, a gambler's fallacy is, you know, you walk up to a slot machine in a casino and you put a quarter in the slot machine. And let's say you play at this one slot machine for 20 or 30 minutes, right? And then you don't win anything from that slot machine. And then you walk away from that slot machine, and then somebody else sees you walk away, and they say, oh, I have a good chance of winning on that slot machine right now, so I'm going to go play that one since that guy just walked away. See, because what happens is, basically, every time you pull the lever on the slot machine, let's say you have a 1 in 1,000 chance of winning. On every single pull, there's a 1 in 1,000 chance of winning. It doesn't matter whether or not somebody else just sat there and pulled that lever 100 times. That does not include your 1 in 1,000 chance of winning on every single pull. So that's the gambler's fallacy.
Yeah.
And
The genetic fallacy, what's that?
Genetic fallacy is basically the origin of a claim being presented. The claim is either true or false, or the thing is supposed to be supported or discredited. See, basically what it is you neglect some aspect of the origins of some event, and then you state that this is why this thing happened. Like we're going to state that what's a good example that I can think of? Oh, we're going to state that Al-Qaeda is the worst terrorist organization in the world and we've got to do something about it. Mm-hmm. Well, the genetic fallacy there would be that the United States created Al-Qaeda, and therefore that genetic fallacy as well as neglected aspect would, in a way, make the U.S. the largest terrorist organization for creating and funding terrorist organizations. And the reason why I say that the U.S. created al-Qaeda is that, you know, numerous U.S. security experts have come out and said that, including the former top U.S. prosecutor under Carter and Reagan, Dr. John Loftus. And, you know, so there is plenty of evidence out there that this was something that the United States actually did.
Yeah, Brzezinski played a big role in there, as far as I know.
Exactly. The middle ground fallacy is another popular one, or the middle of the road fallacy. You have two extremes. Let's say Republicans and Democrats are two opposing political parties. And let's say one of the political parties has a truth and the other one doesn't have a truth, but they automatically take up the opposite extreme position. And then the fallacy would be to decide that a middle position between the first two is the correct answer, so that so that we can settle things, you know, and make everybody happy by just taking the middle of the road instead of being A or B. Let's just compromise. So it's the compromise fallacy, right? Mm. But, you know, so, you know, just because let's say a Republican candidate states, hey, this is what's going on, this is what we need to do, here are the facts, you're not Republican, and you don't want to believe what the Republican said, even though what he said is verifiably factually true, you will automatically take up the opposite extreme position. And then what happens is it goes to debate, and then the politicians vote and everything, and then they take the middle ground, which what they've done is they've accepted a lie or a middle position instead of handling the truth that candidate A, the Republican, presented in the first place. So they're never going to get to the core of the problem. You know, I'm not saying that I'm Republican or Democrat or anything like that. I don't believe in any political party or affiliation. So, poisoning the well is another popular one. It's like, let's say, and a very common one is, let's say, like, some researcher presents some idea that turns out to be wrong. Okay, and that single aspect is proved wrong. Well, a year later, 5 years later, 10 years later, that same person writes a completely new theory, a completely different book, completely everything else, right? And then somebody says, well, that person was wrong on his book from 2001, so anything that he says here today has to be wrong. You know, so that's poisoning the well, you know, and it comes from basically sticking a dead animal in the well to poison a whole tribe of people during a war.
Am I guilty of using that when I condemn Noam Chomsky for his remarks on 9/11?
If you are saying that everything that Noam Chomsky says in all of his works is incorrect, and therefore Noam Chomsky has nothing valid to learn from or study, that would be poisoning the well.
No, I wouldn't. But
if you say that Noam Chomsky on this specific issue was wrong, and here is why X, Y, Z, and here is my evidence, that is not a fallacy.
No, okay. It's not, but I'm assuming here that he is so intelligent that he can see what's going on. And
that would be a hasty generalization or jumping to conclusions. So you have to be careful, all right?
I have to be careful. Yeah. Okay.
Right. So, you know, and the idea, you know, and people also want to make sure that they learn the Latin names for the fallacies too, because that will help a lot, you know, and you'll want to learn the names of the fallacies for Netherlands. Well, I suppose this podcast is going out in English, so it won't matter, right?
No. It would be handy for me indeed. Yeah.
Right. So,
I find it very hard to find any information about the Trivium, though. I guess since they scrapped it out of our education system.
And everyone else's.
Yeah.
So, another popular one is the post hoc fallacy.
Post hoc.
Post hoc or post hoc ergo propter hoc. And this fallacy is traditionally interpreted as after this, therefore, because of this. So a black cat crossed my path today, therefore this happened. You know, A occurs before B, therefore A is the cause of B. You know,
okay,
there was a bright flash in the sky, you know, and I see UFO people do this stuff all the time.
Uh-huh.
And 10 days later, there was an earthquake.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so that's the post hoc fallacy. Okay?
No, that doesn't make any sense.
Right. And, you know, and questionable cause, which is similar to the genetic fallacy. A and B are associated on a regular basis, therefore A is the cause of B.
Uh-huh.
What's a good example here of this one? Joe gets a chain letter and threatens him with dire consequences if he breaks the chain. He laughs and then throws it in the garbage. On his way to work, he slips and breaks his leg. When he gets back from the hospital, he sends out 200 copies of the chain letter, hoping to avoid further accidents. Never mind that the path that he was walking on was wet or slippery. He wasn't watching where he was going or any of those things, right?
Yeah.
And then another really, really, really popular one is the red herring fallacy. Politicians love the red herring fallacy. If you ask a politician a question, what they'll do is they'll divert the conversation to another topic, pretending that they answered the question. Uh-huh. So topic A is under discussion. Topic B is introduced under the guise of being relevant to topic A, when topic B is not relevant at all, and then topic A is abandoned. And then, you know, the person thinks, I just won the debate. You know, and this one comes from the old days, like especially in England and probably in France as well, during the fox hunts. Let me get some more water here.
Sure.
And they would train the hounds to go after the fox. And before the hounds were considered as qualified hunting dogs, what they would do is they would put the hounds to a test, and they would have the hounds chasing a real fox. And then what they would do is they would drag a fish across the trail of the fox to see if they could redirect the hound onto the trail of the fish instead of keeping on the trail of the fox. So this is known as the red herring fallacy.
Mm.
And so, you know, it's a really funny one, but that's one of the most common ones. So, you know, and the idea with studying the fallacies, especially the informal fallacies, is you can begin to apply them right away in your daily life.
Yeah.
And you know, so it's a lot of fun. And I recommend people just, you know, go to the triviumeducation.com website. It's TRIVIUM education.com, and then you know, on there's you know, a couple of listings there for fallacies, and if you go to the reading page, there's a PDF download for fallacies there as well. But by learning the actual names of the fallacies and being able to identify the specific lies, and fallacies comes from the Latin word fallare, which means lie, and to be able to identify the specific lies used against you, you go from implicit to explicit knowledge. So what happens is, you know, let's say you're dealing with a car salesman and he's using all sorts of fallacies. And, you know, instead of just saying, you know, I have a funny feeling that this car salesman is lying to me, you can say, oh, well, now I have explicit knowledge that this car salesman just used an appeal to emotion, an appeal to flattery, you know, he, you know, all of these different things. So then you have explicit knowledge of exactly how you were lied to.
Yeah, it's very good to be able to put words to the things that happened to you.
It's not left to just a funny feeling. You can then relate to somebody else exactly how you were lied to.
Yeah.
Oh, well, you know, I got a funny feeling. I didn't like that guy versus, you know what, that guy just used a guilt by association, a hasty generalization, a red herring, a slippery slope. I can break down this point, what he said right here, that was a red herring, that was this, that was that, and your mind can go through, and the, you know, the more you practice these things, it'll become just instantaneous for you, and you'll begin to see it in you know, people's speech. So what happens then is it begins to act as a mental antivirus to filter out bad information from your head, and then the rhetoric aspect of the trivium, you filter that information out before you pass information on to other people, so that way, just like an antivirus does for your computer system, it filters out viruses coming into your system, and it also prevents you from sending viruses onto others. And people generally spent 30 to 50, 70 U.S. dollars a year for antivirus software for their computers, but they spend absolutely nothing for antivirus systems for their own brains. And this is a big problem, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so people really need to understand that understanding the fallacies in these things and not having a systematic method for spotting BS, for spotting lies, leaves you open to viruses. And we all know what happens to our computers when our computers are filled with viruses, right? And yeah. malware and spyware and pop-ups and all this crap. Well, guess what happens to your heads, folks? You know, think about it. It gets bogged down. It doesn't run well. You believe in a whole bunch of crap, and you spread crap around to others. You're basically like, like a venereal disease going around, right?
Okay, so we got a couple of minutes left, and
sure.
I would like to get into some rhetoric, and I have one thought experiment I would like to do with you.
All right.
So, the rhetoric is basically, this is what I understood from my first lesson in philosophy, is my friend, he said, well, if you can't explain something, then you don't understand it.
Well, that's exactly right.
So, that's where rhetoric comes into play,
that's,
I guess.
That's perfect. That's very succinct. But, you know, he's leaving out an aspect. If you can't explain something, you don't understand it, and therefore you don't know it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
So you go all the way back to the grammar, right? You don't stop at the logic. So the rhetoric is how. You don't know how to explain something, so therefore you don't understand it, logic, so therefore you don't know it, grammar. So go all the way back to the beginning, gather your grammar, know what the parts that you're dealing with, you remove the contradictions, logic, now you can explain the how to others.
Uh-huh.
Rhetoric...
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to read something here. So, you know, and I read a little bit of this prior, but rhetoric is the how of a subject, is applying knowledge and understanding expressively comprises wisdom, or in other words, it is systematically usable knowledge and understanding to explore and find the proper choice of methods for cogently expressing the conclusions of grammar and logic on a subject in writing and or oral argumentation. Mm-hmm. The enunciation of those conclusions is called a statement of rationale, the set of instructions deduced from the rationale for the purpose of application of those conclusions in the real world is called a statement of protocols.
Hmm. Okay, but could we then say that although the basis for Obama's speeches may be filled with lies, his rhetoric is still good?
Well, there is a such thing. Yes, you could say that. Well, mm-hmm. And that would be sophism, right? Sophism is the intentional use of fallacies to win an argument regardless of truth. But you also have to be careful because there is such a thing as the fallacist fallacy. Uh-huh. And that means that when you're listening to somebody, you say, oh, well, everything he's saying is all fallacies. This guy is full of crap. Just because somebody is excited and uses a whole bunch of fallacies when they're talking doesn't mean that they're intentionally lying. So you should still always quickly fact check. Way you avoid dismissing somebody just because of their heavy false rhetoric. Just, you know, you never want to kill the messenger, right?
Yeah.
Which is Plato's allegory of the cave. Don't kill the messenger.
Yeah.
And so what you want to do is, even if somebody is 95% full of crap, that 5% might be valuable information to you that you can use or that may save your life.
Mm.
You know, so, you know, it's like if somebody... You know, you live in a small village and somebody comes running over a hill. Hey, somebody's, you know, attacking us and, you know, there's a whole army coming right over there. Just look, just run over there, you know, and appeal. We're all going to die and appeal to fear and hurry and hasty generalization and all of these fallacies. You know, somebody should be smart enough to stick their head up over the hill and look and say, oh, goodness, you know what? There is an army coming. Hey, everybody, he's not lying, even though he was just using a bunch of appeal to fear and all of this stuff. there is an army coming. Yeah. Let's get busy, right? So, you know, don't kill the messenger. Always, you know, that 5%, even if the person is 95% full of crap, that 5% may save your life. So it's important to listen to the person, filter the information, and, you know, take what's valid and then disregard the rest.
Yeah. Okay. I had, when I went to school and they first told me about this triangle, 3-4-5 triangle, Pythagorean.
Yes, yes.
And I thought, well, this is weird. How can this be? This is, huh? And then I found out a couple of days ago via one of your podcasts that if you take a triangle which has equal sides and you put a circle inside and a circle around it, the circle around it is twice as big as the circle inside. Now, there's another one that, that makes me go, huh? Is there, is there any more of those examples you can give me?
Let's see. You know, repeat that again.
Okay, so the 3-4-5
I'm not an expert at this at the geometry.
Okay, no problem.
Of this stuff. What I would recommend people do is check out Jain Mathemagics, J-A-I-N Mathemagics.
J-A-I-N. Okay.
Yeah, J-A-I-N Mathemagics, not mathematics, Mathemagics. Like magic.
Yeah.
And I think it's just jainmathemagics.com. He's got some stuff in there. Also, the wooden book series, Sacred Geometry. There's also the Quadrivium book there that would go into a lot of that as well.
Yeah, there was talk about five solids and the triangle being a two-dimensional
representation. Right, right. I am still right in the middle of learning all of the Quadrivium material.
Yeah,
and,
let me...
I was just going to say we should mention the Quadrivium very quickly so that people understand a little bit about what we're talking about
here. Sure, sure, go ahead.
All right, the Quadrivium is math or arithmetic, geometry, music, and astronomy. And just like the Trivium has to always be in grammar, logic, and rhetoric, specifically in that order, the Quadrivium is always arithmetic, geometry, music, and astronomy. And arithmetic or mathematics is number in itself, which is a pure abstraction that is outside of space and time. Geometry is number in space. Music or harmonic theory is number in time. And then astronomy is number in space and time.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So this is why it's very important to study these things in order, because each builds off of the last.
Yeah.
And then the golden ratio is what connects the Trivium to the Quadrivium.
Mm-hmm. So there's an interesting verse I would tell to you. It has to do with these five solids, possibly. I'm not making claims here. But they have also this story about what elements the universe is made of, right? And we're talking about these five solids.
Yes.
But they have elements, and they call them earth, water, fire, air, and ether. You must have heard of them before.
Well, and Christians call them Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John.
Okay, so see, but they are five. Maybe there's a connection there. There's another thing added, though, in the Vedic texts.
Earth,
yeah,
water, air, and fire are the primary four, and then plus ether. So the four primary. So then guess you could go Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John plus God or Jesus, right?
Well, it's a bit more explicit.
But if you look at if you go like on the St. Mark's Basilica website for the Catholic Church, you'll see there that they list Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John as north, south, east, and west.
Uh-huh.
And then the four corners are associated to earth, water, fire, and air.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, so they're in alchemical symbolism, there is a direct relationship there. And I'm going to have to follow up on the fifth one, so I can't give you a clear answer. I don't have my knowledge and grammar together on that one.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. It's it's a five of a series of eight, and they are dividing them in five and three. So the last three are mind, intelligence, and ego. They are also considered elements of this universe. But we only have a few minutes left, and I would like to do this thought experiment with you, if you don't mind.
Sure. Well, tell me a little bit about what it's about before
it's not something.
Right?
Not very difficult. You mentioned in the beginning of the show the law of gravity.
Okay.
Now let's place ourselves in the middle of the Earth and jump up as hard as we can, or maybe on a trampoline, and then see how high we get, and compare that to how high we jump, say, halfway up the Earth, or say on the skin of the Earth, and then we jump, and we compare those distances. Do you think that when we are in the center of the Earth, we would jump much higher than when we were at the middle of the Earth or at the top of the Earth?
I think we would jump less high, but you know what? And I just read something about this last month in David Harriman's book, and now I'm not remembering the details of how that one goes. So
okay, but the idea is less high then.
My idea would be less high. The force of gravity would be greater, such as you know, being a scuba diver and swimmer. When you're at the bottom of the ocean, the gravity, the pressure there, but that's the weight of the water.
Okay. Well, thanks for your. I was thinking higher.
You were thinking higher, huh?
Yeah, because if we were to drill a hole in the ground to the other side of the Earth, and we drop a ball in there, it would like June, come back and up and back and down, up and down, up and down, until it reaches the center of the Earth. But the distances would be shorter and shorter and shorter. So I'm thinking this going to bounce a little bit, you know, and not stop right in the middle.
I would have to study Newton's laws of physics in a lot more detail and get my understanding of gravity and things down a lot tighter before I would dare to speculate on that.
Like I said, a thought experiment, you know.
Yeah. Well, okay. You know, maybe somebody out there can answer us. You know, I know there's some physicists that listen to my show, and if I put it out on my side, we'll maybe get the answer if I don't go do my homework.
Very nice. Well, I'm very honored to have had you on my radio, Jan. Very nice. Thanks very much for your time.
You're welcome. I appreciate you having me on. And would you please let me know when you have the show out?
Yeah, I will let you know. It's probably going to be coming Sunday, and I will have a podcast on my site, solvingyourradio.com, as well. And people go to triviumeducation.com. That's TRIVIUM education.com.
Correct. As well as gnosticmedia.com. And that's GNOSTICmedia.com.
Okay. Well, that's it for me, Jan. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you, Walter. And let me stop this recording, and I'll send that to you right now.
Cool.